Hey, welcome back everyone to another episode of GCC Tech Talks. This is the summer edition and we're carrying on through the heat, bringing on guests, having conversations, everything tech of in the GCC region. How you getting on today, Si?
It's 46 out there, isn't it?
46? It feels like 56, but it's getting hot.
It's a bit sweaty, but it's nice and cool in here.
Yeah, excellent. And we've got a slightly different angle for everyone listening. We're talking tech, but legal, in kind of the legal space today. And we have a lovely guest, Mumtaz, who's joined us. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, guys.
Excellent. So we tend to start these very much about who our guest is. So a little bit about yourself, you know, where did you grow up? What brought you to Dubai? How did you get into law? You know?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I was born and raised in England, in the East Midlands. For people who don't know, imagine England's a triangle. I'm kind of right from the center. And I am, for my sins, a career lawyer, although my undergrad's in biology.
Is it?
And after that, I went and did the law conversion and became a lawyer. I worked in private practice for a number of years, and then I sidestepped into being in-house. And I've kind of worked kind of around pretty much everywhere. So I've worked in big law, I've worked in more regional-sized law firms, and then I've worked in massive blue-chip companies, FTSE 100s, and then also more kind of smaller and niche spaces as well.
A quick one. Did little Mumtaz think she was going to become a lawyer when you were younger?
Doctor to lawyer. Yeah. Classic, isn't it?
What was the dream?
If it's not one, it's the other.
Okay. Massive secret, to my shame, I was meant to be a doctor. I dropped out of medical school, and so, you know, being from an Asian household, your options were like, you know, are you going to become an engineer now or are you going to become a lawyer? Those are, you know, you've knocked one out, you've got two options left.
That's it. I can relate.
There's a lot of stories like that in my family as well.
Funny, because my wife did the law conversion as well. She did a history degree and then did the conversion, which is, similar. And then worked in big corporate law firms and then decided that, you know, kids, and then didn't want to go back into that space again.
Although from what you're saying, she's like still, you know, high flying.
Oh, yeah. Out of the two of us, she's a successful one. I look up to her, bless her. She's fantastic.
Well, actually, I was thinking about that. That's how we connected, actually, because she went to King's as a doctor.
That was Si's wife, yeah.
Oh, was that Si's wife?
Yeah, she's also highly successful. We're just lucky that we've got excellent women with us.
Do you know what? My son always says to me, "Mummy's the boss, not you."
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he knows.
He's been trained well. He's been definitely trained well. Definitely.
Sorry, we digress. Went off on one there.
I know, it's always good. Like, you know, we've got a King's connection going on. Did you go to King's as well? Or?
I didn't go to King's, no. Dina went to King's, and she was lucky enough to study computer science there. And then she kind of didn't know what to do after that. I think it was her dad that pushed her into that direction. Me and Dina actually met at LSE when she was doing her conversion to go and do a postgrad in economics. I had an interest in economics. Don't ask me why. I started my kind of working life in IT. And then I met Dea, probably 5 years down the line, shall we say. But I had an interest, always had an interest in economics. Decided I was going to go and do this course in LSE and met my wife there.
There you go. Good thing you had an interest in economics.
Exactly.
So you were going to become a doctor, then decided I don't want to be a doctor. Went down the kind of law conversion route.
Yeah. So I did my degree in biology first because, you know, keeping that door open, you never know. Also, funny you say that. So I met my husband the same way.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, hangers on, kind of just casually find these people and they're like, okay, fine, you're a doctor. And he's a doctor. So, you know, I'm a doctor in a different way. I don't know. There's a Mrs. Doctor camp. That's how we kind of met as well. And there's no more to the story. But then, after I did the law conversion, then I did the law conversion. That was it. Then I've not actually ever done a day's work in anything else, which is quite bad. I probably should work out what other industries do, but I just know how to be a lawyer. And I think I'm too far gone now to actually do anything else. I'm too scared to do anything
else. You wake up in the morning, I'm a lawyer, go to bed, I'm a lawyer. That's it.
Thing is though, I think slowly by slowly, and we're probably going to touch up on this a lot more during the broadcast, but slowly by slowly, I've noticed the legal department is coming out of that realm, of that enclosure. And governance and legal have started to team up a lot more now as well with compliance. Yes. And legal is a massive, massive part of doing business now. You know, it's no longer all just legal documents. It's so much more, shall we say.
Yeah. What, on that then, what, especially in-house, because you said, you know, you've worked in-house as well. What does the role of a lawyer look like today? You know,
As I said, legal functions are generally massive, even in-house. They're like, depending on where you work, they're like tiny little law firms. Mm-hmm. I've worked in companies where there were like 300 in-house lawyers. Wow. And they all have like the tiny little divisions of what they do. But for me, because I work in more of the SMB space right now, I wear lots of hats. So I am the product lawyer. So I deal with, you know, taking software products to market, you know, working with my R&D engineering teams to kind of go, hey, we've got this bright spark idea. And then like, okay, cool. Let's play this game out. Let's put it on a mirror board and let's take it all the way through to full production and launch. So I do that. And that's kind of my bread and butter work, per se. But then I also do, I head up the intellectual property side. So I run the branding campaigns from a legal perspective. And I also manage the portfolios, the trademark portfolios and patent portfolios, because we do a lot of R&D work. So we try and patent a lot as well. So I'm the key person there. I have randomly taken on a new hat to manage ESG, because the person who did it before left the business. And so then it's like, you know, because budgets are tight at the moment, who put their hands up? It's like, I've never done this before. This sounds awesome. And actually, it's such a topical place to be doing right now. So I'm actually really pleased I'm doing the ESG side. And then I also still keep my hand into contracts. So I'll still do like supplier contracts. I probably in another world would have worked with you, Tom.
Yeah, maybe.
All the supply chain works. It's not my main job, but, you know, someone needs another pair of hands to chip in, then I'm around and I do that as well.
I'm fully aware.
Did you notice how many departments you actually mentioned?
I know. It's crazy, isn't it?
And also, did you notice how you mentioned product, business, so, do you know, it's evolved. I would say, especially the legal departments in big corporations, even medium-sized corporations, because products have become so sophisticated, there's so much more legal input. And the legal team actually need to understand the business as well. It's like, you know, us as data professionals, we need to understand what you're actually selling, what you're actually doing, you know, what, you know, the target audience of the product. Those are the kind of things that legal need to understand as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you put that tech hat on, there's a big race, especially in the GCC for, you know, we want to leverage technology and AI, whatever that might look like, and be the first and showcase it. But that adds so much pressure to privacy lawyers, data governance people, you know, legal counsels, whatever that might be, because you're scrapping around. You're also learning, you're trying to learn about the space as well as applying, you know, the regional laws and you know, privacy schemes or whatever that might be around what that business is trying to do. And it's always a fine line, I guess, in your world, of allowing the business to go and innovate and do things and you know, be competitive in the market while obviously trying to make sure there's a level of governance and, you know, liabilities kept in place and everything like that.
100%. And I think that's kind of where my role kind of is very integral to the business. I am, like, I guess, the product whisperer, so that I do the translation between both sides of the fence. So it's very much explaining to other legal counsel, okay, this is what the business is trying to achieve. And then equally to my R&D teams when they're developing stuff, it's like, yeah, guys, that's cool, but have you thought about X, Y, Z and how it's going to impact us? And so, like I said, the way I manage this is very much by being integral to the business. So you know, my engineer here has got this awesome idea. It's kind of like almost built into the ecosystem that I'm one of the very first people he contacts to kind of go, I want to do this. Is this a goer? And then we'll kind of just work through the process to go, actually, have you thought about tweaking slightly here? And, you know, you'd be surprised, like the things that do get picked up. So I'll give you an actual example, a really relevant live example as well. One of my engineers, it was a great, very simple, very small add-on product he wanted to develop. I was like, that's all awesome. But you haven't thought through the fact that this is a SaaS platform. you need to give customers the right to do a, it's called a data subject access request. It's part of GDPR, and customers have to have the right to access their data. And normally it's really simple. You just go into our platform, you click a button and hey ho, you got everything. But he hadn't thought to build it in. And it's just kind of having those conversations then go, it just brings it to the top of mind to go, yeah, I need to do it. And then it gets built into the build process. So then they'll, you know, they'll assign an extra sprint or two sprints, whatever it takes just to get it done. But if they're not having this conversation, it's very hard to reverse engineer than it is to think this through at the start. So
yeah, and as product builders, you've got a million hats yourself. You're like, okay, we need to think about the customer. We need to bring scale to it. We need to bring security. And like you say, you know, you need to make sure that there's frameworks in place to say, okay, well, you know, out of all the things, you know, legal requirements, GDPR or whatever it might be, needs to be baked into those sprint cycles.
Yeah, you want to say something?
No, I was going to say, I remember the first time that kind of conversation happened. It was many years ago now. And I realized that how important it is to bring you guys in so early in the process.
Did you get slapped by a lawyer?
I wouldn't say slapped. I would say it was realization that our actions can have big consequences on A, reputation of the company, B, a product. It, you know, like some products that I've come across where we've had an idea, we've done a POC, and we've realized that we can't actually build the product because it just doesn't comply. And there's no, like, there's so many different ways we've looked at it and tried, it just doesn't apply. It's a fantastic product, but because of certain legislations in place, you can't build that product. You're not allowed to. Well, I wouldn't say you're not allowed to. The problem is the things that you need to put in place totally outweigh what you're going to benefit. So sometimes it's those conversations that you have. You have a fantastic idea, but it can't go into production because of the fact that, you know, you need to use something that you're not allowed to use. Or in order to get the permission to use that, it's so difficult and so costly that, you know, it far outweighs the gains that you're gonna get. So, yeah, I think once everyone's eyes are open to it and everyone accepts it, because I've found a lot of, especially developers, really, really smart developers, when they come from small organizations to medium and corporate side organizations, they can't get their head around it.
No, I don't know if freewheeling and you know those things aren't sort of overlooked a little bit easier in a startup.
And I think that's one of the things that's coming up. I don't know if you've kind of seen a trend. I've seen a trend in AI startups where legal is so important now, and the advice that they want, even on a fractional basis, a small fractional basis, they want to comply from the beginning because they don't want to get to a stage where they're too big, like you said, to go backwards and reverse engineer things. And you might even have to rewrite the product totally from scratch. That's going to cost a lot of time and a lot of money as well.
That's really interesting. And can I just say, because I've done a lot of M&A work as well, one of the many hats I've worn in my life, but depending on the region, this is so... Yeah. So you're speaking very much like this very Eurocentric kind of view, which is awesome, but like... Because there's so much regulation, there's so much legislation, European startups know that if they are not buttoned down when it comes to that investor deal, that M&A, that, you know, they're going to IPO, whatever they're going to do, if they are not buttoned down, the due diligence is going to show all the gaps.
Yep.
Whereas hilariously, like when you buy from the US, and I'm not going to name any names, but the skeletons all come out of the closet.
Yes.
Particularly if you are, you know, a European-based organization looking to buy because they've got an awesome idea and you just want the tech stack. But then you go, oh my God, can I even sell this to my customers?
Yeah.
Yep.
You're taking a product to somewhere like Germany. It's just, no one's ever going to buy this off me.
I'm not going to make any money out of this deal.
It gets far worse when you get to Southeast Asia. I've seen some shockers.
Really?
Yes, I've seen some shockers.
I was going to say, we're talking about cross-border. How did you find, from a legal hat on, moving from Europe to the Middle East? And anyone that's doing, because there's a lot of people that try and move here that want to build careers here. Any advice for lawyers thinking about coming to the GCC?
So I'm going to be completely honest. I used the cheat code in life whereby I got an inter-office transfer. Yeah. So my organization has a headquarters in London, but they equally have an office in Dubai. So all I did was ask them to scratch London out of my contract and write Dubai in. It's the exact same contract, essentially, just in a different market. I still have the same reporting chain. My GC is still in the US. There's no kind of real change to my day to day.
I did the same.
It's a lazy route, isn't it? It's awesome. So unfortunately, I have no experience of trying to get a job in this region. So I can't really speak to it. So I'm afraid, I'm a little bit of a damp squib on that one, I'm afraid.
No, that's right. But I just mean in terms of how the law differs here. Or is your hat still on the UK, US market? Or are you dealing with sort of GCC specific?
So, I get what you mean. Well, because I work for a global company, we tend to go with what is the highest line I need to reach, which is Europe generally. So all of our products are GDPR compliant, are EU AI safe, compliant. We meet all the EU regulations because, yes, every jurisdiction is different, but the view, and I think a lot of big corporates take this, if you're hitting the highest threshold, you're going to have no problem selling into any other market because, you know...
Yeah, you've got that umbrella effect, right?
Exactly,
you're protected all from the top down.
Yeah, so that's kind of how we run it. And I think,
okay, and in the last...
I think the other way around, sorry to interrupt you, but the other way around, I was at a company where, when I came over here, it was the other way around. So they hadn't hit the highest point, but they added, there was an acquisition of a European entity. So it was the other way around. So it's like you explained earlier on about the reverse engineering. And companies, global companies, tend to usually do that, like Mumtaz has explained, to go to the highest level. But I've noticed, I don't know if you've noticed this, in Saudi Arabia and UAE, they're trying to start at that point straight away, even though it's not, before GDPR, as in the DIFC regs that came out, I felt as though everyone was trying to achieve that level of GDPR. And if you look at it worldwide, everyone's got a piece of GDPR, and then they've added their own little bits on, haven't they? I say it's their own version of GDPR, shall we say. So I feel as though it's quite important in this region. We should kind of highlight that, where they are, even though it doesn't apply here, they want to achieve that, so they're ready. I think that's the right way of putting it. They're always ready. They want to make sure that it's equivalent to a market where it's quite a high standard.
You've got to realise the UAE and Saudi and this region is trying to become a big global hub.
Yep.
100%. So, they need to have the process, the policies, the sovereignty in place to do so.
Well, so I'd say it's slightly split. So from the data processing side, so Saudi's got PDPL legislation, and there's, I can't remember the gone from my head for UAE, but there is legislation.
It's DRC,
basically. Yeah. It's DRC, yeah. Yeah, DRC,
it's no abbreviations. I just stick to GDPR.
But they have got that. So the data processing stuff is there. And I think that's, but then the interesting thing is that they don't have it for AI.
Yes.
And I find that slightly scary because there is a massive push to become the next big AI center for the world. You know, AI literacy is at the forefront of everyone's mind. There's hyperscalers moving in at a rapid pace, and not just in Saudi and UAE, but also Qatar, Oman, wherever. There are so many hyperscalers moving in, homegrown and international. And AI is the wave of the future, but there isn't legislation. And this is not just specific to this region. Yeah, it's a global problem. We can talk about that more if you want. But what I think this region should be doing is setting the benchmark. The time is now. If you can get out there and get your legislation be there first, because even the EU, this has got the EU AI Act, but that's more about transparency than it is about how AI should be managed, the outputs of AI should be managed. So if we can get out there first, you are the world leader, and then the world looks to you for guidance on how it should be managed. So I think there is something there, but they need to act on it. And that window's closing every day.
Let's double click into that. What do you think is missing globally when it comes to AI? You talked around the risks there.
Okay, so this is coming from an intellectual property perspective. And I want to go back and I want to tell a story. That's all right.
I love a story. Yeah. Stories are great.
We love a story.
So this is about a man called Dr. Stephen Thaler. He was, he's not dead. He's a computer scientist.
So blase.
He's a computer scientist, an American computer scientist. And back in the 2010s, he built essentially the precursor to LLMs now. So he had these like continuous algorithmic models, and he built several of them. But then what he did with a couple of them was he tried to get registrations done in their names. So there's two specific examples, and we'll do them both separately. He had one where it developed digital art, basically. Mm-hmm. And in the US, is the rules on copyright are slightly different to the rest of the world. So generally in the world, a copyright is an unregistered right. So, you know, if you write a beautiful piece of code, it vests in you at the time of creation, provided it's your own creative work. In the US, they have the option for you to register it too. So like that vesting happens in any case, but you can also register it if you want. And so what Dr. Thaler did was he went to the intellectual property office in the US and basically said, my system has created this AI. I want to register it in its name. And if that fails, I want to register in my name as the person who owns the system.
Okay.
So there's no involvement by him in the creation of this output. Yep. It's very much, I own the system and the system gets named. And this actually went pretty much all the way to the Supreme Court of the US. The US Supreme Court refused to actually hear it, so it ended up one stop below. Okay. And every leg of this journey that he went on, the court said no. AI cannot own the output of AI. Mm-hmm. And you cannot own the output because you've done nothing to develop this output. So it kind of gave you this very clear-cut view on how copyright is managed. But this is very US specific. It varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But what Dr. Thaler found, and we'll go to the patents in a second, but he uncovered and made it like known that this is how the law is going to interpret AI outputs from an intellectual property, from copyright perspective going forward. But also this is the gap. So what do you need in order to be able to own the output of AI? And subsequent to that, the US Trademark Patent Office actually did come back and they've put some guidance out. There's some more papers being published, but as it stands, it's a little bit woolly, but the guideline is you need to have had enough involvement in that output in order for you to be able to own the copyright. So your beautiful code that you've written, because you're sitting in San Francisco now, and you've written this beautiful code, it's yours only if you've added enough into it. You haven't just gone into Lovable or Cursor or wherever and gone like...
So there needs to be some sort of justification
exactly.
And proof.
100%. So that's what he uncovered. And then what he also did was he had another system, and I've actually got this piece of paper just because I can never remember the name, and it's awesome. He had this AI system called Davos, which is Device for the Autonomous Bootstrapping of Unified Sentience.
Okay.
I don't know. What's the most awesome name? If I'm going to name an AI system, I'm going to give it a random name like that. But we'll call it Davos because that's easier. So he has Davos. And with Davos, he, again, is another AI system. Again, it's a precursor to LLMs, but you can just think of it like that. And it created some patentable ideas. One was like a food storage container and something else. So he had two ideas. And this time he went to the UK. And he went to the UK patent office and said, I'm going to register this in the name of Davos. Mm. And if I can't do it in Davos, I'm going to register it in my name as, again, the owner of Davos. And he used a really random, really old doctrine in UK law, which is, I forgot what it's called. Estoppel? Ascension. Something like that. Ascension. We'll go with that. Don't quote me. But basically, it's ye old English law to basically go, you know, say I'm a farmer and I own this cow. I then own the calf because, the cow can't own the calf. I own the calf.
Yep.
So he used this same doctrine to prove
that. That's a really intelligent way, isn't it?
My algorithm is a cow. It's a calf. It's a
the output's the calf. Yeah, I own it because I own the cow.
Yeah. Love that.
And this did go to the Supreme Court. And again, much like the US, they're like, no. Computer says no. Yeah. So you don't, the AI can't own it. And equally, you can't own the output because you've done absolutely diddly squat here.
And diddly squat, that's the farm. We're talking about cows and Jeremy Clarkson. So there's no pun intended there.
Anyways, he then was like, and this is why I love Dr. Thaler. He was like, no, we're doing this again. So he also applied in the EU, and there's something you can do called a PCT, which is basically like a springboard patent. So he can use the UK patent and springboard into other jurisdictions. And he went everywhere. He went to the US, he went to New Zealand, he went to Australia, he went to South Korea, he went loads of places. Like, man had money, clearly. And he was just like, but he wanted this point proved. And sadly, it was uniform. It came back, AI can't own, Davos owns nothing, and it's not your calf. You can't own it just because you said you wanted to own it. And so I like, it could have gone either, if it had gone the other way, I still would have found it very interesting. But what it did was prove categorically that AI in everywhere in the world that he applied to, which is loads of places, AI can't own the outputs from a patent perspective. Yeah. And equally, you, if you've not done anything, can't own that output. And so that, I guess, it's a brilliant legacy because he forced that conversation to take place and for that to be found. But then that leaves the other part. So like, what can you own as, you know, you're a coder, but my God, you love Lovable, and Lovable's doing half the code. Clearly for you it is.
Let's not admit that while the cameras are
not
rolling.
Not while we're in it.
And so what we've got there is actually every jurisdiction has a slightly different position. And it's interesting because it varies on different points in different jurisdictions. So we take the EU. The EU's probably got the highest bar to meet from a patent perspective. Okay. But interestingly, from a copyright perspective, it's a lower bar because what it does say is that, I've written it down because I can't remember. I've got the wrong way around. So it's got the highest bar for human contribution from a patent perspective. So you've got to make the most effort. But from a copyright perspective, you've got kind of more protections because you've got something called TDM exemption, which is basically you can do text and data mining. And there is actually a directive in place in the EU that says is actually for the other side to say that they want to opt out, or you can actually mine on their data. So therefore, you can actually theoretically own more of the output. The UK is probably the most permissive at the moment because they actually have a law from 1988, which was written very much when the computer era was coming into force, to say that actually, provided you made the conditions viable, you own the output from that computer.
So we're in this interesting world then, because what a lot of companies are trying to do is build agents that act and become autonomous. And I guess this is probably where you're getting to. So if you've got all these agents and, you know, in the world that everyone tries to envisage, got agents creating and doing autonomous work and building product autonomously, I guess we get into that grey world of like, do we actually own the copyright for that, or can someone else, another agent, go and build it and copy it, and we've got no leg to stand on?
Yeah. Sure, what? There's another question there as well. And this has only popped to my mind just now. Is if that's the case, when it outputs and it's autonomous, are we liable?
It depends. Like, I guess what is the output? What are you developing that you're worried about?
Yeah.
So that would swing on the facts. And yeah, imagine there probably is, well, yeah, on the fact there may be some liability, but going back to your point, yes, you're 100% right. People are now becoming more and more dependent on their agents. They've got so many running constantly. They're putting all their media content out there. They're putting all their, you know, their code in their databases. And it's just it expands more and more. And if it's purely autonomous, as Dr. Thaler has proven, you don't own that output. Therefore, a competitor can just as easily go, ooh, I like the look of that app. I'm going to develop it myself. And this is where you end up in this really murky space from an intellectual property perspective, because you haven't got a leg to stand on. And then the other part of that is, what does your contract say? Because you will have a contract with Lovable, with Cursor, with Claude, with, you know, whoever you're using. What do the terms of your contract with them say? Because if you're running an enterprise license, you'll have negotiated. So I negotiated the enterprise licenses for my company for various tools, and I negotiated with them to make it clear that any outputs that are developed belong to me, to my company. Whereas if you're on a personal license, does it say the same thing? And that's something that, especially for startups, that's really, really relevant because likely they're on personal licenses and they won't have negotiated terms. Do they even own the outputs, or does the LLM own the output? In which case it becomes even more of an issue where, you know, anybody who's buying that tool, and if they're training on your data, if they're training on your outputs, which likely they are if you've not even got the rights to own them, anybody can put in the exact same prompt and get the exact same output. And it becomes, I think, harder and harder to own anything. And then I guess the final thread on that is employment contracts. Because if you've got employees, and I'm guessing, you know, people who are in organizations of a certain size, they will have standard employment contracts that will say something like, you know, anything you produce as part of the course of your employment belongs to the employer. And, like, you know, standard. But they won't be accounting for AI. Now, say I have my own license to Claude, which I do, and say I decide to use my personal license to Claude to develop a beautiful contract because I've done it on the weekend. And then I just, like, you know, email it to myself. Do I own that contract, or does my employer?
That's an interesting point because that will apply to thousands of people listening to this. 100%. Everyone's doing some of this on their own personal work. That's an interesting point.
But also, if you don't do that negotiation, then the company still doesn't own it. Correct me if I'm wrong here.
It depends. So this is, again, this will fall very much on the facts because each contract will be different. And you have to, like, so take an example just from real world experience. Claude automatically gives you the rights. So if you buy an Anthropic license, whether you buy a personal license or an enterprise license. I'm talking from UK, by the way, because I did this in the UK. I have no idea what it says in the GCC.
Just caveat that quickly. For all our GCC friends listening.
Go to London and this is what I'll say. You own the outputs. Okay. So Anthropic made that super clear. But like I said, I bought this in a different life, so I don't know what it says. I don't know what it says from a region to region basis. And again, so this falls on so many different facts. Are you buying in the GCC? Are you buying in San Francisco? Are you buying in London? Are you buying in Munich? And what are you buying? So it all spins very much on the very specific facts. And also then, what are you buying? So again, going back a ways, Lovable, I know, quite clearly says it owns all the outputs. And this is like, you can just go on their website and it's super clear. You've got like this very clean drop down thing. And it says, you create code with us. Cool beans. We own the output. And so if you're not negotiating a contract with them and you're just a personal person who's just got a one person license, Lovable owns your outputs. And again, spins on the facts. Lovable, please don't sue me. I'm saying this very much from the time when I looked at this in London.
I think it's the employment contract, I think, super interesting, because then you've got competition law. You know, if I'm leaving my company and going to a competitor, you know, there'll be stuff in your contract that says, okay, you can't take those assets away and use it for competitor. But if I've built it accidentally, without, you know, knowingly or not, with personal licensing, then where does the company stand on stopping my competition getting hold of a load of great content that, you know, you, I have created from using a personal? Interesting.
No, exactly. And that's where I think HR departments and just all organizations really need to be thinking about this and going, actually, the AI generation is here now. Everybody is using AI, whether they're disclosing it or not. Odds are most people, especially in the tech space, are using one to two to three different types of LLMs. And they need to button down employment contracts to make it super clear that even if you're doing this in your own time, in your personal instance, we still own the rights to it because it's a work product. I want to say that Dr. Thaler did ask that question because he did try to convince one of the many cases where he tried to say that the output was a work product because it was work for hire done by his AI system, and the court said no.
So let's talk a bit about tech and AI in law then. I actually interviewed for an AI law tech company. Ooh. Super interesting. But I kind of see it in the world that, you know, we're in data. Coding is a lot more, is a lot easier to do, can be a bit autonomous. So, you know, is it going to eat up data engineering time or whatever that might be? You know, paralegals coming into the sector. You know, you've got AI applications out there that can read contract documents and are trained and skilled up in the world of law. How have you seen your role and the role of a lawyer in-house or for firms change in the last couple of years?
So my organization is very AI positive. I have a massive stack just through my employer, so I don't actually need to be using my personal accounts to be using this because they are very friendly with that. But it does mean that then we are working leaner. Open heads are staying open. Like I said, I took on a whole new role, a whole new function, because I have various different tools sitting behind me that can help do my research. So the stuff that my paralegal would have done, that my junior lawyer would have done, I don't need because AI is doing it for me in 25 minutes, which would have normally taken a week for someone junior to kind of research and put a memo together for me. I don't need anymore. So in that sense, I think teams are going to shrink, particularly AI-friendly teams. But I think this is a short-term fix. And it's not just a legal problem. This is across the board, because I imagine the exact same thing is happening in all spaces. But if you're not training juniors up, who's going to take over? Like at some point, I'm going to get old, I'm going to retire, but who's going to take over after me? And I think it's a very short-minded kind of view on things. And I think within the next few years, it will start course correct, because you're getting all of these graduates come out and they've got nowhere to go. And yes, I get it. Companies want to cut costs wherever they can. And, you know, a license to Claude is infinitely cheaper than paying for a paralegal. But there will be a skills shortage. And even if it's just training juniors up to become really good at prompt writing, that's a skill in and of itself. Yeah. And I imagine like an 18-year-old is going to be a much better prompt writer than me. And so train them up to do that. And, you know.
You've got an interesting point there. We've spoken about it on the other podcast.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. It's the spanner thing, isn't it?
Yeah, with the cogs. So you're going to need people. I don't think people are going to go anywhere, right? We're in this weird situation where there's a race to AI and we want to be more efficient and show the markets that we're saving costs and introducing AI. But, you know, I see this world. I was looking on Instagram and there was a kid. He interviewed for a consulting gig at one of the big four. Got the role, was about to start. Sorry, your job's no longer there. We're trying to be more efficient. So they were bringing in AI, keeping the staff that they had, but actually weren't bringing in a load of new graduates, which causes the problem. But then did you have a world where you've got a sales AI agent trying to sell, you know, or your company, say, has an AI sales agent selling a software to another company, and then you've got that agent trying to sell the software. You've got an agent buying the software. You've got the legal agent trying to do the contract negotiations. We're all going to be sat here talking about how it's all running the world and we're just having coffees and talking about it.
On the bright side, no one's going to own any of it.
No, it's just going to be
in a legal vacuum.
Do you know what's going to be interesting is when we kind of see big examples of that supply chain where the agents actually sit in different organizations and they're all communicating with each other and what the outputs are going to be from that and how efficient it's going to be. And do they have the relationships that you usually have with, like, you know, account managers and people on, you know, on the business side, shall we say? And that's going to be really, really interesting to see. If I could see that, I would say that supply chain, even for one process, shall we say, just, I don't know, buying, I don't know, all the products for housekeeping, should we say, for a hotel or something like that. That'd be really, really interesting to see if it actually works. Because I don't believe that we've got to that stage yet.
Oh God, no.
Definitely not.
Did you guys see that thing where they put all those different AI agents together? So you had like Claude, you had Grok, and like then they just went on some crazy rampage, didn't they? So I don't know if these agents are going to be talking to each other in a sensible way.
That's what I was talking about, because from what I've seen, when certain people have done it, like they're usually quite crazy, should we say, these guys have basically set up agents that they force them into fighting with each other. How do you break up that fight?
You can't. They're going to lock you out.
Who breaks up that fight?
Oh, good. Okay, so we're almost up on time.
Oh, okay.
I know these things go very quick when you have a good conversation. So appreciate it. Would love your take on, what are your favorite tools that you use? In tech, doesn't have to be AI, but what do you turn to use and recommend?
So Claude is my new best friend.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a very strong emotional attachment to Claude.
I do as well. Yeah, don't worry. I know exactly.
How same. I use Claude pretty much every day.
So there we go. That's our unanimous winner.
Yep, definitely.
But then, what else do I use? Lawyers are quite boring. I live in Word and Excel. I still type stuff out manually. I find it scary and hard to use a dictation function. It's no, I must be typing everything myself. Yeah. So
my wife, she comes from background. She's amazing at Excel, and I don't think she would ever give that up in her wildest dreams.
I know.
Do you know what? Most of the lawyers I've come across, especially in the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years, they love speech to text. They love it. That's one thing I've always come across with the lawyers, speech to text.
But mate, have you seen how long our memos are? When you're writing a 20-page memo, that speech to text really saves your fingers.
Yeah. That's one of the tools that I've always seen. Legal, the guys, they love the speech to text. And anything that is more advanced, if say, for example, they've got a version or they've got some sort of piece of software, usually a SaaS platform that they've got, and something else new comes out and it's 10 times better, they just want to switch and they keep switching. And they don't mind learning that new tool, shall we say, because it's so valuable to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I
And you write about some of this stuff, do you?
Yes. So this is more of a passion project of mine. I write a Substack called Obiter Dictum 1. Somebody stole Obiter Dicta from me. and I mostly just write about things that I like. So I really love case law and the intricacies of cases, like the Dr. Stephen Thaler case, and I just write about them. It tends to be about AI, mostly tech, lot of IP in there. So, if anybody's interested to learn more about Dr. Thaler and related case law, that's where you can find me.
Brilliant. Well, I've definitely got some lawyers back in the UK that I'll share this podcast with in your Substack.
Thank you very much.
We'll put the Substack notes in the show notes so people can access it. And if anyone wants to say hello, is you on LinkedIn? How do people get in touch with you?
I will be sharing this podcast heavily on my own LinkedIn, don't worry. Brilliant. So I think people may hopefully find me that way. But otherwise, it's just my name, which is Mumtaz Kynaston Pearson.
Oh, yeah, we'll put your LinkedIn in the podcast notes as well. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah.
I've learned so much.
Thank you so much.
Do you know
what?
I don't think we've laughed so much on a podcast. Yeah. Honestly, really? Honestly, I think the laughter today has been more than any other podcast. So thank you.
I've had a
thank
nice core workout.
Yeah, thank
today.
You so much.
Who said that lawyers are not entertaining?
I've never said that. I've always liked the legal department, if I'm honest.
You've got to keep legal on your side.
You need to come work
side.
For me. You're on it with the regulations. You speak to lawyers first. You like us. Please, come work with me.
Yeah, especially lawyers who have to work for tech and software companies. The end of a quarter is the worst nightmare for a lawyer. They're up until 3 a.m. trying to get stuff done for salespeople.
Do you know, if we do have time, I'm just going to share a really small story. I will be really quick. The reason why I love the legal department so much is because of an experience I had many, many years ago. And I realized how important the legal side is. And I think that's once you realize that part and the consequences of a wrong decision down that path, you actually realize that they are your new best friend. It's like, you know how finance are your best friend? Because they are the ones that get to pay for it.
Yeah, pay your salary. So what was the story?
I'm not going to go into too much detail. I can't reveal the two.
Fine. Everyone, if you want to know the story, I'll leave his mobile number in the show notes. You can call him. Real. Well, thanks, guys. How lovely. We'll maybe grab some dinner or something after this. But yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right, Ron. We're good. Thank you, Omar, for editing for us today.
Do you know what, Omar, can I say something? All I'm going to do is do this.
Omar.
Fantastic, Omar. You are absolutely fantastic. I didn't hear anything from you. That's amazing, Omar.
He was editing the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
Omar, what we need now is how can you...
I see one thing.
Yeah?
The board was creaked at one point.
We couldn't hear it. How good are you at taking pictures? Can you take a picture of us? Good man.
Oh, please share that with me as well.
Yeah, yeah. We-